You're live with Get Connected. Mike Agarbo here in studio. We've got a great program for you today. I've got Gray Williams with me. We're going to be doing a deep dive on robotics. Of course, we're a show all about technology, kind of making it fun and inspiring to understand. We're going to be talking with Philip Smith. He is with Sanctuary AI, a really cool Canadian robotics company, and they're developing the next generation of robots. More in a general purpose format, like humans that can walk and have hands. And it's going to be interesting to chat with him because all the challenges that people that are making robots have had over the years that they are just kind of coming to grips with, so to speak. And also the software and the AI behind powering them all as well. And we'll even go further looking at what will the implications be for robots in society. Why do we need them? There's some interesting stats that'll blow you away. Gray, thanks for coming in on the program, as always.
I was glad to be here.
We're going to dive into some of the tech news stories that we're following this week. This is a big deal. Big trade war with U.S. and China. I think we've been aware of this for a few years now. The U.S. is trying to limit the technology going over to China in you know, as far as the tech and the machines that can make semiconductors and things like that. They've limited the export of that. You have to have special licenses. So that has kind of slowed China down. And now China is hitting back. They are tightening controls over the exports of two very key materials used to make computer chips. And I don't think a lot of people have heard of these before. One is gallium. And another one is germanium. And so they, I think, respectively, produce 60 and 80% of the world's materials with those two, which is a lot.
And these are important materials. You know, like gallium nitride, the new chargers that we've seen out do an excellent job of dissipating heat, which is kind of the killer thing with processors. You know, Moore's law was kind of soldiering along just fine. That's the law that says that computing power will double roughly every 18 months. And that was happening because we were making things smaller and smaller and smaller. The problem is, as you make things smaller and smaller and smaller, it's harder to get rid of that heat. And so we've got materials like this that help you do it. This right here, though, is sort of an interesting negotiation tactic. Right. Janet Yellen, the U.S. secretary, is headed over to have trade negotiations. So this is an opening gambit, I think. You know, we're going to restrict these materials. OK, well, you know, you guys want some software licensing or other things from us. Let's, you know, trade, as they say. China runs this is sort of an interesting game because while they do have the lion's share of these materials, there's no rule that says that these materials are the only ones that could be used. And I mean, you're one mining discovery away from this not being a thing. So it's a very interesting place to sort of place to put your piece on, as it were. I'm curious to see how the U.S. responds.
Well, they'll ban something else. do you know what I mean? Like, I think they're concerned about China. And they should be. China, you know, I've been over there a couple times now. I've visited the factories. It would blow you away at just how advanced they are and how integrated they are. And they have a cheap labor pool on top of that. And they're just automating further and further, you know, making more robots to basically man these manufacturing lines. So, you know, the U.S. has got a lot of catch up to do there. The U.S. is very good at developing the technology. Do you know what I mean? They're excellent at that and innovating. So China is the next world superpower. There's no question. And I just, you know, will this slow them down? I don't know.
Unlikely.
You're tuned in to Get Connected. We're talking about some of the tech news stories that we are following. You know, we talk a lot about AI in our program. Interesting. They're using AI now, training it to recognize waste in recycling. So approximately, you know, over 200 billion tons of solid waste was produced in 2020, according to the World Bank. And that's likely to rise to close to 4 billion tons by 2050. They're obviously trying to do more recycling around the world. And now they're using AI to kind of, I guess, scan waste that's coming in for recyclable materials and kind of separate it from waste.
Can I get one of these for like my kitchen? Because I'm sitting there at some point going, is this a number three or a number seven plastic? And this is organic? This is organic, right? We can't, the pizza box can't go in the cardboard because it's got organics. I need some help here. Like some AI would actually be great for me to be able to go, okay, this is recyclable and this is going to be on the earth until the end of time. If they could give me that help, I'd be all for it. Because I got no idea right now. And the stickers on the boxes are not helping. Because I don't know if you've ever seen this in my apartment building here. Every single box has a different sticker that seems to imply something different on it.
I know.
I'm just asking for some consistency.
And I can't even imagine sorting all of this. Because, you know, right now I'm at a detached house. So we just dump everything into that recycling bin. That has to be sorted. And typically by humans. And I would say, from what I've read, most of it doesn't even get recycled because it's not supposed to be in the recycle bin.
I've totally seen what I like to call the effort factor, which is people are trying to sort things and eventually they just go, eh, and they just toss it all in the dumpster. That's the thing that you got to overcome. So this type of service here, you know, obviously as they're doing this large scale for the processing.
Yes.
You know, this is technology that absolutely will be miniaturized.
Hopefully. Well, so there's a startup out of the UK. It's called Grey Parrot, and they've created an AI system that they have installed into waste processing and recycling facilities. So, you know, they've got, I think, about 50 of these sites in Europe right now, and it uses AI software to analyze what is passing through these conveyor belts in real time, which, you know, I think, you know, is on par with humans in most cases. But it, I mean, there's a stunning amount that it's processing. They say just on those 50 sites, they're tracking 32 billion waste objects per year. 32 wow. billion. Isn't that insane?
It's insane. This also adds some accountability to the recycling claims that we're hearing from some companies, right? You know, everyone's looking to move towards the circular economy. Everybody from Nespresso to IKEA, and that is where we need to go. But we've seen on more than one occasion, you know, quote unquote recycling programs have not been recycling programs. They've been basically outsourcing trash to different places in the world that will take it. If we can see some accountability here and see these companies make sure they're doing the right thing and not just paying for the right thing to appear to have been done, that's also a huge step forwards.
Okay, one quick story here. This was interesting. Airbus is developing new technology called Project Dragonfly that is designed to extend the ability of autopilot. So right now, for these big commercial jets, they've already got a lot of, you know, these automated systems that help them, you know, for example, land. You know what I mean? Like they can actually help the plane come into the airport and the runway, you know, in line. So this new Project Dragonfly is taking that autonomy even further. And the idea is that, you know, and they're experimenting on this, but if a pilot were to become incapacitated in any way, ideally, this system would be able to take over control, descend, and land, all the while making sure it's looking out for other planes, the weather, and the terrain itself.
This is almost, you know, like giving the pilot sort of a superhuman ability, right? You know, the extra senses, so you can see what's going on around you, some decision-making, and in the event that something happens, your passengers are still safe. Like this is great. Good on Airbus.
Well, it's interesting, right? Because it needs to be able to talk to the air traffic controller people, the towers. So it's designed to actually pick the most suitable airport for diversion and also calculate all these different variables and be communicating with the air traffic controllers at the same time. So they've already done two successful emergency descents. So it's an interesting story and something that we'll definitely be following up on. Okay, we are going to have to take a break, and you need to stick around because we are going to be talking with Philip Smith. He's with a company called Sanctuary AI. And it's a deep dive into robotics and where we're at. You know, why don't we have our own personal robotic butler? Well, there's a few hurdles that have, you know, people have had to overcome in making these. And you'd be surprised at what some of those are. But also, it's kind of the integration with the software and artificial intelligence. So it's a fascinating conversation, and I really think you should stay tuned to to listen to it. You're listening to Get Connected here on the Chorus Radio Network. Back after this. You are back with the program. Mike Agarbo here in studio. Going to start off a very interesting conversation about robotics and artificial intelligence. We've seen AI kind of explode over the past year. That doesn't mean that it hasn't been going on for years as far as the development, but it's really become part of the, I guess, public consciousness with tools like ChatGPT, Midjourney.io, et cetera, et cetera. We've seen robotics advance over the past 20 years as well. Still not totally there as far as humanoid robots in the workforce. But I think we're getting close. We've got a really interesting guest with us today. His name is Philip Smith. He is with a company called Sanctuary.ai. Thanks for joining us, Philip.
Thank you for having me.
We had a chance to meet at the Collision Conference in Toronto last week, which was fascinating. And what a difference a year makes, Philip. The previous year, it was all about the metaverse. But this year, I think every single company presenting seemed to have some sort of AI connection.
Yeah, that's true. I think, you know, there is definitely a shift in terms of the conversation, depending on what's hot, what's popular, and what's trending, especially amongst startups and the venture capital community. So whether it was, you know, crypto or autonomous vehicles or the metaverse, now it's AI, you know, it's all signifies something, usually that there's been a meaningful development in one particular area, and it creates a lot of buzz and a lot of interest and a lot of conversation.
You've been in this game a long time, Philip. What happened to the metaverse? Like within a year, I mean, last year it was just all the rage, and this year you're not really hearing as much about it. AI just dominates the category.
Well, it's interesting. There's still a lot of work being done and still developments being made, but the, you know, the popular sort of focus is, you know, it will be fairly fickle and it will shift from week to week, month to month, or year to year, depending on. I think what is most interesting is whenever you popularize something. So the fact that ChatGPT and large language models were made available to anyone, that makes it much more accessible and much more the focus of conversation. So I think that's what you're seeing. And I think that will, like with all technologies as they emerge, that will shift anytime you have something that, whether it's search or large language models, whatever happens to be, that will become the topic of the day for some period of time. Doesn't mean there isn't a lot of other developments going on in other areas. You know, artificial intelligence has been worked on for a very long time, but it was only really popularized in the last 6 to 9 months.
So let's just kind of set some groundwork here, Philip. Tell us about the company you're with, Sanctuary.ai. Like, where did you guys come from? What do you do?
Yeah, so Sanctuary, the full name is Sanctuary Cognitive Systems Corporation, but popularly we call ourselves Sanctuary AI. It's a little easier. The company is 5 years old and was founded by Jordy Rose and Suzanne Gildert. This is their third company, and it was spawned of predecessor companies, the first being D-Wave, which was the world's quantum computing company that was founded by Jordy Rose, and then Kindred, which was a robotics company that used what's called reinforcement learning to train a robot. In this case, to store packages in a distribution center. So that was the beginning of the sort of foundational work and interest in terms of what became Sanctuary. Sanctuary's mission is to create human-like intelligence in a general-purpose robot. And so when most people think of robots, they think of factory robots or industrial robots that tend to do one thing very quickly and do it very well. But they only do one thing. So a general purpose robot is something that's able to do, is inherently flexible and is able to do a much wider range of tasks. And when you sort of fuel it with AI, it becomes very, very useful.
Where are you guys located? You're Canadian, right?
Yeah, so we're based in Vancouver.
So we've seen robots, they've been around for many years now, and you've made a good point. They're kind of single-use robots. You know, they're used, I guess, extensively in manufacturing lines. And I guess to your point, the next evolution would be general-purpose robots. Are these like a humanoid form, or what kind of form are you guys envisioning that these things take?
Yeah, so for a robot to work in the world more broadly than just in a, you know, a particular station in a factory or a manufacturing line, it has to be able to work in the world, and the world is designed for people. So everything from the height of shelves to handles on doors to tools or whatever you might think of, it's designed for people. The average person is, you know, five foot eight, they have two hands, they have two feet, they walk around. So any robot that's able to work and be flexible and do a number of different tasks will have to have something equating to the human form in order to work. Otherwise, you have to re-engineer the entire world around you to suit the robot, and that obviously doesn't work.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I'm really big into science fiction, and there's been all kinds of different imagining of robots in the future. But to your point specifically, if they are to become part of our life and part of our worlds, they have to be able to access the same things our humanoid forms do.
Yeah, that's right. And if you think about it, you know, there's lots of science fiction. Sometimes it hits the mark and sometimes it misses the mark entirely. Today, there are robots around us. You just maybe don't think of them as robots. So you talk to Siri, you talk to Alexa, that's technically a robot. You might have a Roomba vacuum whipping around, you know, your living room floor. That's a robot. So there are bits and pieces of it around us, but it hasn't consolidated into a single machine that is truly capable of doing a wide range of work. And importantly, and this is where our focus is, on work that is particularly dull or repetitive that people today don't really want to do. And as a result, you get a lot of job vacancies and a lot of job turnover, or jobs that are inherently dangerous, that might involve the risk of injury, or that are distant, that require people to fly in somewhere at great expense to do a very simple task and then fly out. So that's sort of where we're going and trying to address by creating a robot control system, which we have branded Carbon, and a general purpose robot, which we have branded Phoenix. You combine those two and you're able to start to scratch the surface of, you know, economically viable work, but in a very flexible way.
We're talking with Philip Smith. He's with a Canadian company called Sanctuary AI. They are developing the next generation of robotics. We're going to have to take a break. When we come back, we're going to dig a little bit deeper as to why robots aren't everywhere yet and what challenges lay ahead. You're listening to Get Connected here on the Chorus Radio Network. Back after this. You are back with the program. Mike Agarbo here. We're talking all about robotics and artificial intelligence today. Where are the robots? We've seen many, of these in workplaces, single-use robots. But what's happening with the next generation? We've got a really interesting guest with us. His name is Philip Smith. He's with a company called Sanctuary AI. Thanks for joining us again, Philip.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
So we've been talking about general purpose robots that are more of a human form. We've seen a few. Like I remember even like 15 years ago, like Honda had some sort of, you know, human-like robot. Boston Dynamics does as well. Why aren't we further ahead with robots?
I think it's for a couple of reasons. One, they're quite complicated to engineer and to solve a lot of the sort of essential problems that you need to solve for them to be able to do general work. Some of the earlier robots that you mentioned, like Honda's Asimo or Boston Dynamics Atlas robot, what they have largely tried to solve is locomotion, in this case, walking. Which is not an easy thing to solve, but that is largely a solved problem in robotics today. But then there are other problems you have to, and that may not be obvious, the ability of robots to grab anything of any shape or size, that's rendered difficult if you just have a very basic grasper or a suction cup, which is typically what robots have to grab onto things. But you can imagine, you know, it's very tough to do a lot of things every day with just graspers or just suction cups. You need really, again, the world is designed for people, and a lot of the objects we deal with are designed for the human hand. So you have to effectively create a human-like hand. And then you have to solve for a number of other different problems, which includes coordinating what the robot sees in terms of its vision systems with how it grabs and what it feels with its touch sensors, which we call haptic sensors. And so you have to have that interaction between all these various things. So there's a lot of sort of grand challenges involved in robotics that are that the industry is chipping away at over time. So it may not be obvious to the average observer to say, oh, yeah, you got a walking robot, but you know, in some cases they don't have hands. So they can walk, but they can't really do much once they get there. So what a lot of you've seen in robotics in the last, you know, couple of decades is the breaking down of all these problems into their component parts, and now it's being put back together again in machines that can do a lot more.
It's interesting. The human body is a lot more complicated than we give it credit for, eh?
Yes, it's incredibly complicated, and you don't realize it until you try to sort of replicate it. You know, the human hand has what we call, you think about a degree of freedom, like you're moving your finger up and down. The human hand has 20 degrees of freedom. There are over 30 different distinct grasp types associated with the human hand. So you think about picking up a cup, picking up a bar, you know, grabbing a handle, whatever. So when you think about it and you dig into it, it gets quite complicated.
So hands, that's the next stage of evolution for robotics?
Hands are, we've spent a lot of time focusing on the hands from a robotics perspective. Obviously, there's the software control system, which is, you know, I'll call it where the story really is. But from a robotics and the physical hardware perspective, the hands are very important because you have to be able to pick up small objects. You have to be able to pick up different shaped objects. The hands have to be, you know, you have to get feedback from them. They have to be powerful enough, but not too heavy. They have to be reliable and robust. And, you know, when you think about the human hand is a wonder of evolution, but it's quite complicated. And when you try to replicate it, there's some things that work and some things that don't. So we spend a lot of time doing that, because if you have a robot that can walk around or move quickly, but it doesn't have hands, it really struggles to do anything of economic value.
I imagine there'd be a lot of companies out there working on hands. Is there like any open source robotic hands, or like, are you guys sharing technologies or information?
Well, there are a lot of companies out there working on different types of hands, and there's different types of technologies that can apply. You can use electrical motors, you can use cables, you can use hydraulics, you can use various other forms of technology to make the hands work. There's been a lot of work that's been done on prosthetic hands, obviously, for people who have suffered, who are amputees. And then there are a number of companies that have worked on different hands to do different things. So there's a lot of competition and there's a lot of innovation. But you then have to, a hand is a component of a robot, like just as legs are, or vision systems or touch sensors and so on. And you have to be able to combine that all together successfully and then have a control system that can not only get the robot to do what you want it to do, but over time do it autonomously, but safely at the same time.
And how far are you guys away, do you estimate, on functioning hands? I know that's kind of a tough question sometimes, but are we like decades away or years away?
No. I think it's very tough to assign timelines on this, because you're oftentimes dealing with eureka moments of innovation where things click and you solve a challenge. We've been working on the hand for a very long time. We have various versions of our hand for our robot itself, Phoenix. It's the sixth iteration or sixth generation of the general purpose robot, and we have multiple generations of the hands as well. So the hardware is quite close to being in a state where it can be validated for engineering purposes and then validated for manufacturing purposes. It's not this year, but it's in the near future.
Okay, so you've got to make all the physical components. How does the software, how does AI all kind of integrate with this? I mean, that's, I guess, an integral part of making this work.
Yeah, you think about it. So you have a robot that has its general purpose in nature and has a human-like form to it. How do you control that robot? Well, you have to have a software system or a control system, which we've branded Carbon, that is a big tent and can incorporate a lot of the latest developments in artificial intelligence or in vision systems or other forms of sensory systems and integrate it all together. So you think about the human brain, if you were to sort of deconsolidate the human brain, you have parts of it associated with common sense reasoning and parts of it associated with task planning and parts associated with vision and different other forms of senses. You basically have to mimic that in the form of a software control system and do it in a way that if there is a development in one particular area that is publicly available, you can pull it in and incorporate it such that the system is sort of a big tent and everything underneath it is state of the art. And if you're able to do that, then you can have a machine that continues to get better at what it can do. It can be faster, it can be more precise, more reliable, safer as well. And so that's how you need to work. So you can imagine it's a fairly complicated process to have the hardware and the software and all the various components and to synthesize it all together and have a machine that can work effectively.
I think when we think of robots, some people are concerned about the future. Should we be concerned?
Well, there's a lot of concern, I think, and speculation about AI. Obviously, there was the letter that was signed by many people saying you should slow down, develop an AI or put guardrails on and so on. And many of those concerns are justified. Some of them are speculative. Obviously, people don't know how things are going to evolve. When it comes to, using artificial intelligence in the field of robotics, it's a much more confined issue, a constrained issue. If you think about, the risk is limited to the actions to the robot. So a robot is not going to take over a power grid or, hack into your software system or anything like that. It is what it is. It's out there. It might be, stacking shelves, it might be cleaning, it might be doing some other thing. It's basically performing within the application described or defined for it. So our view is that embodied AI in the form of a robot potentially has a lot less of the risks that are speculated about with AI today.
We're talking with Philip Smith. He is with a company called Sanctuary AI, a Canadian robotics company that is kind of trying to develop the next generation of robotics, everything from the physical aspect, but also integrating the software AI. We're going to have to take a break, Philip. I just would like you to stick around. I want to talk about where the future lies as far as society and how robotics will influence the workforce. You're listening to Get Connected here on the Chorus Radio Network. Back after this. You are back with Get Connected. Mike Agarbo here, having a fascinating discussion about robotics and where that's all headed. There's a really great Canadian company called Sanctuary AI that is leading the race there. We've got Philip Smith with us from the company. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
From what I understand, you guys also partner with companies like AWS, Amazon Web Services. How does that all work?
Well, we have a number of different partners, and because if we're dealing with a general purpose robot performing work in the field, it will require, cloud services, it will require edge compute, it will require lots of other things, 5G, for example, that are important to it. So there's a number of different providers that we're looking at, including AWS, amongst some others, in terms of, providing that. Given the nascent stage of the technology, trying to understand all the inputs it will require to function properly, you know, the wireless connectivity, the data storage, the, you know, maintenance, the supply of parts and so on. That's something we're working on to determine, you know, what the future requirements are and what the appropriate partners are.
So you've talked a bit about these general purpose robots doing, you know, tasks or a set of tasks and function in a workplace. Let's start looking down the road. You know, what does this mean for society? There's no question that robots are developing. They're going to be here in the next 20 years in some meaningful way. What are some of the jobs that you see that they will, I guess, first start being integrated into?
It's a good question. I think what you need to do is back up and look at the big picture. And in certainly in the developed world and increasingly in the developing world, we're seeing populations start to tip over. Populations are aging. The demographic trends aren't favorable. And what that means going forward is you're going to have much fewer people to do the work. So today in the United States, there are 10 million job vacancies. In Canada, the figure is roughly a million. And that's before you see, you know, the next generation of people retire. So just across, like, for example, the G20, the working age population between now and the end of the decade isn't scheduled to grow at all. The retirement age population is going to grow by about 55 million people. So think about that. That's 55 million people less to do work in an environment today where we already have huge number of job vacancies. So there's the populations tipping over because we have below replacement birth rates. That can't be solved solely by immigration. Many of the traditional sources of immigration for North America, countries such as China, are starting to see their populations decline as well. So that means there has to be a technological solution to address that in order to maintain our standard of living. And the first thing I think we're going to see robots and what this will mean for the workforce is they're going to start doing jobs that people don't want to do. So those are jobs where you have high levels of turnover that don't meet modern expectations for work, and that is they're really repetitive or rote or boring, or they're inherently dangerous, or they're extremely high cost for the economic value they provide, and that would be jobs, for example, that are distant. So it's tough to say outright where you'd see, you know, which industries when, but in general, there's definitely a societal benefit from the development of this kind of technology, in that it will mean jobs that people didn't really want to do or are tired of doing begin to be automated. So you've seen these waves of automation in the past, and they've always resulted in a higher standard of living for people, and work that is more, I guess, more enjoyable and have greater job satisfaction. So think about the introduction of the steam tractor to farming, for example, the introduction of the computer chip and the automation that came with that. These are all things that I think will have, this should have a similar impact, with the one caveat being that the populations are no longer growing as quickly and they're aging quite quickly now as well.
Well, you brought up a great point there. And you mentioned China. I know South Korea, Japan, their fertility rates are dramatically down. I think South Korea, their population could halve in, you know, by the turn of the century, which is devastating, I think, to some economies if you don't have enough workers, like you're saying, to actually do the work. And a lot of people, you know, when they think robots are going to be taking our jobs, but to your point, that might not be the case when we have millions of jobs that aren't filled right now.
There's that for sure. The other thing is that anytime you have a new technology that's introduced, new jobs get created. So you think about, you know, how many people today have the job of a robot pilot? I say virtually nobody.
So a
robot pilot is essentially somebody who oversees a group of robots doing work and intervenes when a robot gets stumped or helps guide them. So there's, you know, is always basically a supervisor for a fleet of robots. So that's an example of a job that doesn't exist today, but may exist in the future. So not only will jobs that that are currently vacant be potentially occupied, the remaining work will be higher quality because all the tasks that people don't want to do, they don't have to do anymore, and they can focus on the things they enjoy doing, and new jobs will be created. You know, the area, for example, of machine learning and things like that.
Well, it's interesting. We've looked at technology changes throughout human history, and it's not like, you know, robots are, you know, tomorrow going to take away 10 million jobs. It's always kind of an evolution, isn't it? It takes a number of years. And to your point, new jobs are created with the new technology.
Yeah. So you think about robots in general, they were first introduced into manufacturing settings over 50 years ago. Yet today, if you look at the total amount of money spent on robots every year, it's 0.1% of the labor bill for people. So the human labor force is still 1,000 times larger than the amount of money expended on robots 50 years later. So if that's the robots are coming, it's a very slow, it's a very slow march. So while there's always technological developments that can accelerate that and represent an inflection point, new change, and so on, I think that's important context when you think about, you know, how robots have added, have been introduced and have automated certain tasks, mainly in industrial or manufacturing settings, not really in service settings yet. But there's always gaps in automation, and those gaps are always filled by people. So, and that isn't going away anytime soon.
We're talking with Philip Smith from Sanctuary AI all about the future of robotics coming to a country near you soon. I want to thank you for joining us. And where can people find out more information about what you guys are doing?
So you go to our website, which is www.sanctuary.ai. There's also a lot of, news articles and a number of books being written about this topic. There's a book called Prediction Machines by Ajay Agrawal, which is a very interesting book that covers this topic comprehensively. And I expect you're going to see more news in this area as we go forward.
Thanks again for joining us, Philip.
Thank you for having me.
Don't forget to tune in to our sister program. It's called The App Show. It's on Sundays on the Chorus Radio Network. Of course, it's podcasts like Get Connected Radio as well. It's a really great program that we have tomorrow. We are going to be chatting about Meta and the new Instagram Threads. This is the big Twitter competitor that they have come out with. And already tens of millions of people have signed up. But can it be successful? Will this just be another Google Plus that died out back in 2019 that had literally hundreds of millions of people on it? Well, you'll have to tune in and learn more. Also, Meta and Google, they are basically pulling all the news from their sites. And when we say Meta, that's again Facebook and Instagram, because they don't want to comply with the new Online News Act that the Canadian government has basically legislated, where they have to share advertising revenue. Well, now it looks like the government's fighting back again, pulling their advertising from Facebook. So we're going to explore where that's all going. And, you know, can there be some compromise like they have done down in Australia? And secure messaging. A lot of messaging apps have end-to-end encryption, but governments are going after it. We'll explore that as well. I want to thank Gray for joining us today. We'll see you again next time.